Hello, welcome to Bare Naked Politics. This is the podcast for people who want to keep up with the headlines, but who don't declare to be politics experts. If you want it all simple and straightforward, then this is a good place for you to be. As well, sometimes the news just moves too quickly, almost. So you need someone to almost pause it and catch you up on everything before you can take anything else in. So that's what I'm here for. I'm Julia Bell, and today I want to get you up to speed on what has to have been the worst couple of weeks in Rishi Sunak's political career. He's seen an utter descent in public opinion via the public opinion polls, and he has been batting away somewhat of a scandal surrounding his wife and her tax status. And of course, the timing of that just couldn't have been worse for his political image, because he's the guy in charge of the cost of living crisis, and therefore he's the guy in charge of our rising taxes. It's under him that our taxes have been going up. So a scandal around his family's tax status, it's just no fun for him. And not to mention the fact that, you know, his choices in how he's handling the cost of living crisis has not been that popular amongst a real variety of groups, including from people within his own party. And then, of course, on top of all of that, he recently got a fine. He recently got a fixed penalty notice from the Metropolitan Police for having broken COVID regulations. All one man, Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor of the Exchequer for the UK government. So it's been a busy time, and not necessarily in a good way for him. And I think the real challenge for this is just me cramming all of these various issues he's been facing into one podcast that's hopefully under 45 minutes an hour. So let me guide you through all of it. Illegal parties, tax scandals, energy price crisis, all of it. And on top of that, in this episode, I caught up with Anna, who owns a bakery near where I'm from in Yorkshire. And I was just really compelled to share the story of her local business in line with this episode, because we're talking about the cost of living crisis. I wanted someone to break down just how much more it is costing to run a business and how that is impacting their income. I think it's just such an important case study. And she was so open and transparent. She just told me the numbers, black and white. So that will really hammer home the sort of severity of what we're actually facing here. By the way, the name of that bakery is The Oven Door in Wetherby in Yorkshire. So if you live anywhere near, then do pop in, because it's really great. And also, I really appreciate her taking the time to share her firsthand insight into this. So a lot to get into. I'm certain by the end of this, you'll come away with a really solid understanding of all aspects of it. Please make sure you're subscribed to this podcast if you haven't done that already. You just click subscribe or follow if you're listening on Spotify. And please give it 5 stars. That's really helpful for me, because it means that other people can discover me easier. So if you find it helpful, other people might too. Chuck 5 stars on it and that helps. Okay, with that said, let's unpack the worst week of Rishi Sunak's political life so far. So I mentioned it in the intro, but Sunak's popularity rating has been hit, to put it lightly, following, but not exclusively, because of his spring statement. And a spring statement is like a mini budget where the Chancellor does a sort of small scale version of when he announces the full budget. And it's just basically telling us, you know, what are the financial plans for the next 6 months, and how are we going to tackle the upcoming challenges? So that's the spring statement. And after his spring statement at the end of March, YouGov polls showed that the majority of the British public now have an unfavourable opinion of Rishi Sunak. I mean, compare that to like March 2020, 2 years ago exactly, when, you know, he was the guy that everyone looked to help to keep us all afloat, to kind of save the day. It is an astonishing dip. In fact, let me get this YouGov poll up. So it's Rishi Sunak's net favourability, and the title here is that it's down 24 points in the 2 weeks since his spring statement. 24 points in 2 weeks is just so bad. So yeah, not looking good, and it seems to only be getting worse in terms of how happy the public are with him. So let's look at why. Let's break down these different reasons. First, there's the stuff around his wife, and her name is Akshata Murthy. She's the daughter of an F-off massive billionaire, basically. His name's N.R. Narayana Murthy. And he founded this stonkingly massive Indian-based IT company called Infosys. And according to Forbes, as of this month, so April 2022, his net worth was around $4.4 billion. And I know that the term billion is a bit disputed about how much it actually is, but in the US, a billion is 1,000 million, right? So his net worth is supposedly 4,500 millions. 654th richest person in the world, again, according to the Forbes billionaires list. Akshata, his daughter, is Rishi Sunak, our Chancellor's wife, right? And she has a 0.91% stake in that tech company, in that IT company, Infosys. That alone, just that stake and the dividends from that, put her net worth above the Queen's, right? Murthy, and I've looked this up because I'm just fascinated at how wealthy she is. Murthy is sitting on around £690 million held in shares in Infosys. The Queen has about £365 million to her name. So 690 for the Chancellor's wife, 365 for the Queen. Basically double. Excellent. Anyway, who cares, right? You're not necessarily a villain just for being rich. So what's the story? Well, the headline around this is that Murthy has been enjoying what's known as a non-dom status in the UK. And therefore, she hasn't been required to pay a little thing we're all far too familiar with called tax on any overseas income. So, I mean, if she's been earning here, which I believe she has, she pays tax on that because that's here and it's her income tax and she pays on it. But anything that she gets from overseas, she's not had to pay for because of this non-dom status. Okay. And all of this Infosys stuff is an overseas income. All of these millions and gazillions of pounds, no tax on that. And holding a non-domicile or non-dom status, it basically, just to kind of explain it a bit more, it means that you are declaring that your permanent home is outside the UK. So in her case, her claim is that her permanent home is India. To claim this status, you kind of just have to provide evidence that your intention is to eventually move out of the UK. This is not your forever place. So things like, where do you own properties? Where do you plan to be buried? Things like that are all brought into consideration. And you can claim non-dom status for 7 years, okay? And then following that, you just have to pay this sort of charge and then you can keep rolling it over. You pay £30,000 annual charge to the Treasury, to Rishi Sunak's department, and then you can keep your non-dom status even if it's beyond 7 years. And how long has Murthy been living in the UK, I hear you ask? About 9 years. So she's 2 years beyond that deadline where you don't have to pay anything. She's now paying 30 grand a year, but not taxes on her overseas income. And she gets about £11.5 million a year in dividends from her dad's IT empire. So 30 grand a year is a really good situation. So how much annual tax would she have paid if she'd not been able to enjoy non-dom status is the next question. Well, the BBC estimates it would have been about £2.1 million a year. That's an awful lot more than 30 grand. So now that we know what non-dom status is and what a non-dom is, we have to ask, is what she was doing actually against any laws? And the answer is no. Because of this non-dom status thing, she's avoided paying tax because of it, but she's not guilty of tax evasion because she's worked within the confines of the law. Incidentally, it's her husband that sets these laws, but there is no law against enjoying rules that are set by your husband. And the legality of this is something that Rishi Sunak has been at pains to remind everyone of. You know, no one has broken any laws here. And it looks like he has the support from his own benches on that one. You know, if you listen to conservatives speak publicly about this, most of the time they'll say, you know, he's not done anything wrong. Have a listen to, for example, Kwasi Kwarteng, who is the current business secretary. He publicly defended Sunak on Good Morning Britain.
Look, what I am concerned about is that she was following the law and that there's transparency and there's been complete transparency about her situation as a non-dom non-domiciled resident, as it were.
Yeah. But
that's been around for 200 years. We've had non-dom status for 200 years.
The point is...
And it's very clear what that means.
There we go. Kwasi Kwarteng there defending Rishi Sunak. But, of course, from the other side of the benches, he's received immense backlash. I mean, that's completely unsurprising. Labour have gone in on this. And they've written to him demanding to know if he himself has benefited from his wife's tax status. Because he is an elected MP and he is a British citizen and he is the Chancellor of the Exchequer. And the Lib Dems have urged Sunak to ban the partners of ministers, so wives, husbands and so on, from claiming non-dom status. Lib Dems have said this is a loophole and it shouldn't be allowed that partners of elected politicians should be able to claim non-dom status and not pay taxes on their overseas income. So, yeah, opposition very much outraged and in disbelief. That's their vibe. And Keir Starmer actually called it, quote, breathtaking hypocrisy at how, you know, one of the wealthiest MPs ever can increase taxes on working people whilst his own wife, who is skin-shiveringly rich, just hasn't been paying them on what is the biggest chunk of her income. But Sunak is just deeply unimpressed with how Labour have gone about this. In fact, he's kind of convinced that they're on this smear campaign against him, so much so that he's written to Boris Johnson asking him to launch an investigation into his own affairs. So Rishi Sunak's saying, investigate me, please go for it, to sort of prove his innocence. And that has been a bit Marmite, I suppose, in terms of how people have received it. Some say that that's really cooperative and clearly Sunak is confident that there's nothing to be ashamed of if he's asking for an investigation. But others are saying, well, an investigation would be a colossal waste of taxpayer money. And that's a resource of which Sunak knows full well we have an extremely limited supply. So let's not spend it on, you know, what some are calling a bit of a vanity project to clear your name. Up to you to decide where on that spectrum you land. But what is interesting is, after all this has happened, and questions have been raised about, you know, yes, it's legal what Sunak's wife was doing, but is it ethical whilst Sunak hikes up all of our taxes? His wife has now come out and said, look, I'm not breaking the law in theory, but I don't want my tax status to be a quote-unquote distraction for my husband. So I'm going to pay the tax, at least for this year and the year just gone, and, you know, put it to bed. And that kind of has sort of helped to settle the debate down. It was in Twitter, she sort of said, look, what I've done is entirely legal, but she said, quote, I understand and appreciate the British sense of fairness. So the narrative that she wrapped it in was very much, I'm doing this because I want to, not because I have to. The last thing I'll mention on this is that there's this question mark around, where did this story come from? You know, who leaked the details of Sunak's wife's finances to the press? Because she's a private citizen, and a private citizen's tax details are, well, they're just that, they're private, right? So that could be very well perceived as an effort to, you know, put Sunak's name through the dirt. Who's got that agenda? So that's kind of the speculation. Is this an intentional, quote-unquote, hit job? And the papers have had an absolute field day with this narrative that Sunak is absolutely furious and he's kind of on a mission to unearth the leaker. Are they from the Labour Party? Or is it even from within Number 10 Downing Street? So that, you'll see a lot of that on the front pages, this sort of political speculation about this potential rivalry between Number 10 and Number 11, between Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak, and whether this leak was an intentional jab to undermine perhaps Sunak's chances of succeeding Boris Johnson as Prime Minister. That's a lot of the talk, but again, I've got nothing to back it up. It's just sort of speculation within the press. So I'd keep an eye out for stories and investigations around where this leak actually came from. I think that's quite interesting. But please bear in mind, Sunak's critics are definitely saying, well, hang on, good try, Mr. Sunak, at trying to redirect the witch hunt towards finding the leaker, when really the witch hunt so far has been directed towards you. So don't try to deflect all of it. Okay, so that's part one of this extensive series of Rishi Sunak's worst couple of weeks in politics. But putting his private life aside for a second, it remains as bad, really, if you look at his entree as Chancellor around tackling the cost of living crisis, which, by the way, is now expected to be the worst it's been since the 1950s. So the quality of life that one can expect in the UK, not been this bad since the 1950s. That's what kind of experts are saying. And I've done a whole episode on explaining the cost of living crisis, but just to put it really simply and quickly for you to get you up to speed, this whole nightmare is a compounded set of problems, right? It's a bunch of things all happening at once that mean our lives as UK citizens are about to become, or are already becoming, way more expensive. So one of those compounded issues is just simply the cost of stuff that we heavily rely on is going up. Gas, electric, oil, food, supplies. So if you want to know why, listen to that episode. But it basically means filling up your car is costing more, energy bills are costing more, and even buying stuff like a coffee and a cake at your local cafe is undoubtedly going to go up in price because that cafe has to pay their bills and they're going up as well. So everything everywhere is in this cyclic hiking up process, which is hurting everybody, right? The other sort of compounding feature in this is taxes going up as well. So we're paying more for stuff and we're getting less in our pockets every month when we get our paychecks. And that is a Rishi Sunak policy, to put it simply, because he is hiking up the national insurance tax that we pay. And it's rising by 1.25 percentage points. In real terms, it feels like 10%. So a 10% hike in your national insurance, right? And that, the claim from Rishi Sunak is, look, I'm raising this tax solely to really help the NHS and social care, which took a big hit in the pandemic. So we need to build that pot of money back up again. So this is a short-term plan, but guys, you're going to have to pay more national insurance for the time being. And I said in the intro of this podcast that at the end of March, Sunak did this spring statement, like a mini budget, where he outlines what's happening financially for the next 6 months and sort of what he plans to do about it. And in the lead up, the hope for many was that he's going to change his mind on raising national insurance tax. Because 1.25 percentage points, like I say, in real terms, feels like 10% for a lot of people. A 10% increase in national is so much money. So the hope for many was that he would just sack that idea off, change his mind and find another way. Look at another method of getting that money in the pot to help the NHS. And the other hope, I think, for many was that there would be some big save the day blank check to subsidise energy bills or to subsidise, you know, some of these costs. But alas, when the spring statement came around on the 23rd of March, neither of those things particularly happened. Yes, he announced some slight measures, but frankly, nothing that was a total overhaul. Have a listen to a bit of it.
People should know that we will stand by them as we have throughout the last 2 years. Yeah. Today, I can announce for only the second time in 20 years, fuel duty will be cut. Yeah. Yeah. Not by one, not even by two, but by 5 pence per litre. Yeah. The biggest cut to all fuel duty rates ever.
Is that it?
So there you go, lots of cheers from within the Conservative Party, but kind of audible dismay from the opposition. You could hear at one point someone from within Labour go, "Is that it?" So very mixed views in Parliament. But to break down kind of what was covered in the spring statement and what's worthy of note, and I'll do it really quickly so it's straightforward. But the first thing he said was, I'm not changing my mind on national insurance. Stop telling me to not do this because I'm doing it. National insurance hikes going up, but I'll raise the threshold of the amount from where it kicks in. So before, it was about at the 9 grand mark that you had to start paying national insurance. I'll raise it to 12 grand. So that means if you earn 12 grand a year or less, you actually just don't have to pay national insurance at all. So that's, you know, a help for people in that category, extremely low earning category. If you earn more than 12K, then at least you don't have to pay national insurance for that first 12K. So I've lifted that threshold and hopefully that kind of initial 12K not being taxed in national insurance will help. So that's something, and it is definitely going to help people on the way lower end of the spectrum. But that 1.25 percentage point increase is still there, right? So it's still going to feel like 10% more on the bit that you do have to pay of national insurance. So if you earn like 40K, then yes, that 12K of it isn't getting hit. But then the rest, so the other 28K that you earned, the national insurance on that is going up by literally 10%. So that massively undermines the help that you're getting. It is still going to feel like a way bigger tax hike. That's one thing, and that's kind of the most controversial thing, and I'd say, judging by the coverage, it's the thing that's pissed the most people off, is that this national insurance thing is still happening. One more thing that's worth mentioning, I suppose, is that there's a bit more money, around £500 million, going into the Household Support Fund. The Household Support Fund, which is basically something that the most vulnerable members of society can apply for, like a grant, something that they can apply for via their council, and it helps with their energy bills. So you can check to see if you're eligible for that, because Sunak is giving that fund a bit of a bounce. So there's more money in the pot to be had if you are eligible. And then also he mentioned that there's a 5p cut in fuel duty. But when you're filling up a full tank of petrol, 5p per litre is going to be like a pound. So about a pound savings every time you fill up. Not nothing, but not life-changing. I have to say on this, the best person to follow, and the way I understand it all, frankly, is from the money-saving expert. He's called Martin Lewis. I'll link a YouTube video where he explained all of that in more detail in the episode description, because he's such a gem. I want you to follow him. He's a really good resource, and he puts it like what I do with politics, but with money. He does it in a language that you can understand. So Martin Lewis, please give him a follow. But the general response to Sunak's sort of spring statement, from unions, from the opposition, from the public, is that it just isn't enough. And to be frank, the national insurance threshold change, the 5p fuel duty thing, it's just not proportionate in terms of help to the hardships that ordinary people are going to be facing. I mean, energy bills are going to rise by 54%. 54% now that the price cap has been raised. So everything you've been paying plus half again is what the average kind of expectation is. So anything really that Sunak proposed in the spring statement just isn't going to scratch the surface on that front. And this is where I want to share my conversation with Anna, who owns the Oven Door Bakery in Wetherby in Yorkshire, which is quite near my folks' house. And I started by asking her, how is this cost of living crisis actually affecting you? Give me the numbers, give me the specifics. I want to hear all of it.
I'm going to give you an example. For example, sunflower oil, we used to buy a 5 litre for about £6, something like that.
Right.
2 weeks ago, it was £39.
Yeah.
And all that is the effect of the war. It has gone down now again. And don't quote me on this one, but now it's in around £20. And for example, flour since September has gone up 40%, just like that.
Oh my God.
We just had an email 10 days ago, and no warning, another increase. Because normally with our people that we buy, they give us a warning. So when we do our weekly order, we know it's going to increase and we can make a decision of how much to buy. What we have been finding is that we don't get warning.
And can I just quickly ask?
Yes.
You said sunflower oil.
Yeah.
You saw a difference from £6 to £39, and it seems to have settled at 20. You don't know where it's going to go in future. Yeah. Is that because of the war in Ukraine, do you believe?
That's directly. Well, that's what we were told. Yeah.
And the same with flour?
I think there are biggest distributors in Europe. So that's why.
Okay. Yeah. And what about energy? Because obviously you guys must use quite a lot of energy.
Yeah, energy is... It is. I mean, we used to pay £1,000 a month, and now we pay about 3,000. That's how much has gone up. It's not gone double, it's gone three times. So then, what you used to do, we have our ovens. Our ovens have to be to certain temperature before you start baking. And so to do that, we used to leave them on overnight. So when the bakers arrive at midnight, they can just start baking. So now to try to save, what we're trying to do is we're trying to one of the bakers will arrive slightly early, turn them on, they start doing other things, and then baking to try to save for those, what, 6 hours, 8 hours of having the ovens on. And it's doable, but it means harder work for our bakers. It means that they finish a bit later. And it's, you know, we are trying as a business to do what we can to save on electricity, but the price of electricity and petrol is so high, and you, and the thing is that we need it, we run everything electricity, you know, so yeah. So it's nothing you can do. Even if you do little savings at the end of the month, you still come in with a massive bill. You know, in the past, if you have an increase, let's say on sugar, there was a big increase on sugar about 2 years ago. And obviously that really affects us in all the confectionery. But you will talk to somebody else, and because they didn't affect, it didn't affect them as much, they will not understand why you put your prices up at the moment, because everybody, everything is increasing. Nobody has a problem. Well, not a problem, but nobody questions our increases.
And people get it.
We have not increased it yet as much as we should. So at the moment, what we're doing is, as I would say, we're working harder and earning less. Yeah.
Because, bottom line. Yeah.
Yeah. Because it is, I mean, you're talking about little confectionery, you know, a caramel shortbread or a brownie. Yes, you can pass it on. But it's going to come to a point that a customer is going to think, it's not worth spending X amount of money on a brownie if I don't have to. It's not something that people have to buy. And you can buy it cheaper, maybe not same taste and quality, but you can buy it cheap in a supermarket.
It is,
you know, it is a fact. So we can only put, we cannot pass all the increases on to our customers, because it needs to be a balance for customers to still come into the shop and not going to somewhere like a big supermarket.
Can I ask about the specifics then? I've had so many of your chocolate flapjacks and I've never actually checked how much they are. how much were they and how much have you put them up by?
The chocolate flapjacks, I think they're £1.15. Now, that is the problem now, because we had one increase before, just before Christmas. Because we thought that's it, you know, that would be our increase. But because things keep on coming up, in this last month, it has gone up again last week. So I think, I wish I had it on top of my head. I think it's £1.15 now, and it was 95 pence before. So it has gone up about 20p.
And you're right, because if it goes up to sort of £1.50, £1.60, £1.70, that is so much on 95p. Yeah. So you are trapped in the zone of it being reasonable for the customer, but without you completely destroying your business.
Yeah. I mean, there are certain products that we are going to have to ask ourselves if we can continue doing them. Because almond slices, how much can we increase it? Because almonds have gone really high as well. So there are going to be certain products that if we increase it and it doesn't sell, we're just going to have to stop producing. So it is those sort of decisions that will have to be made in the next 6 months.
I didn't actually think about that though. Some things, everything's going up, but some things are going up loads. And for you, it just doesn't make sense to make that thing anymore. And it's so interesting. Almond slices. I mean, I'm on the outside. I can't anticipate what you're going to tell me, but it's quite surprising to hear that, okay, I'm potentially not going to see almond slices on your layout anymore.
I mean, this is a sort of business decision. So you're thinking, do we absorb it for 6 months and see how it is? Do we make it, you know, it's just decisions that you have to ask yourself, because if you are not making a profit on a product, it has to be a real good reason to keep producing it.
You think it's going to be somewhat proportionate. So you think, okay, chocolate flapjacks used to be 95p. Now they're £1.15. Maybe that's how much proportionately the oven door is suffering. Yeah. Actually, what you just told me is that you've had to pay £39 for the same amount of sunflower oil that you used to have to pay £6 for. So that price increase in the chocolate flapjack is not proportionate to the cost that you've had to deal with. That's the bottom line, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it is not. So it is really difficult. You cannot be, as a business, increasing your products every week or every 2 weeks.
And you can't even be it's not like you're a stock exchange. You can't like go in and be like, I wonder what the price of a chocolate flapjack will be this week. Will it be up? Will it be down? Like you can't be fluctuating. No, you have to be consistent.
Yes, exactly. And other thing it is, I have not heard anywhere how they're going to help us, how we're going to cope. Expect you to just deal with it.
And there's almost this kind of assumption that some businesses just won't survive.
Yes, unfortunately, I think so. Yeah.
What does the future look like for your business, the near future? Can you hang on in there, do you think?
Well, yes. Yes, we are, as I said, we are very, very lucky, very blessed that we have a very loyal customer base. And I think because our products are not expensive, you know, compared to another bakeries or to another, I think we can increase it and still would be cheaper. So I think probably okay for the next 6 months. We'll see how things are going, and we're just going to have to increase prices and just get a feel from the customers, how do they take it.
Okay, that was Anna, who co-runs the Oven Door Bakery with her husband. And they just have such a lovely, quintessential local business in a farmer's market town in Yorkshire. It kind of fills my heart with joy when I go in there and I get my bits and my parents get their bits delivered. And it's just a nice experience. I feel just terrible that they're being so intolerably squeezed by this thing, as everyone is. And I really encourage, you know, if you do live near Yorkshire or if you're passing through, pop in, say hello, get your bits. You won't regret it because it's a really, really good little place. Okay, now to round everything off, let's talk about this kind of third and final element that feeds into the worst couple of weeks of Rishi Sunak's political career, and that is the fact that both Rishi Sunak and Prime Minister Boris Johnson have been fined £50 by the Metropolitan Police for breaking COVID regulations and attending a birthday party, Boris Johnson's birthday party, no less, which is interesting because when Partygate was in its prime and in its hype, kind of back in December, Sunak managed to not be involved. His name wasn't really part of the coverage and people didn't even, I don't think, suspect him of breaking the rules because he just stayed clear of it. But here he is. He got a fine alongside the Prime Minister. Both of them have issued apologies. Rishi Sunak said, quote, I understand that for figures in public office, the rules must be applied stringently in order to maintain public confidence. I respect the decision that's been made and I have paid the fine. So that was Rishi Sunak. And also Boris Johnson, he got a fine as well. This was his response.
Today, I've received a fixed penalty notice from the Metropolitan Police relating to an event in Downing Street on the 19th of June 2020. And let me say immediately that I've paid the fine and I once again offer a full apology. And I have to say, in all frankness, at that time, it did not occur to me that this might have been a breach of the rules. But of course, the police have found otherwise and I fully respect the outcome of their investigation.
That was Boris Johnson's statement after receiving a fixed penalty notice for breaking the very COVID regulations that he not only set, but tirelessly instructed us, the public, to keep. So yes, we've had a recognition of wrongdoing, but both men, both politicians, Johnson and Sunak, have refused to resign despite so many calls from the opposition to do so. And these calls are based on the idea that they both misled Parliament. And that's such a key theme. If you mislead Parliament, then you're seen to have broken the ministerial code. If you stand up in Parliament and intentionally bend or evade the truth, you've broken the ministerial code. And that, according to the etiquette that is, you know, our parliamentary democracy, that is grounds for resignation. Okay, so that's the line that the opposition are taking when calling for these resignations. But both Sunak and Johnson, their current line on this at the time of recording is, we haven't broken the ministerial code because we didn't mislead Parliament with intent. We didn't do it on purpose. And they refer to the fact that this party for Boris Johnson had been impromptu at the time. And so they didn't plan it. They didn't really know what was going on. And they kind of at the time thought it was within the rules. Here's my problem with that. Johnson and Sunak, both extremely well-educated men, I might add, their pleas of ignorance ride on it being believable that they were not 100% clear on what the rules were. So this idea that they just, frankly, got it a bit wrong and they weren't 100% clear. But these are the rules that their government wrote, designed, and I think this is really key, communicated to the public. They were the conduits of these rules to us. And yet somehow they didn't quite catch them, but most of the public did. How is that possible that the messagees got the message better than the messengers? I just find that very confusing. And on the off chance that this really is the case, and they weren't clear on the rules that they set while we all were, then surely this is grounds for concern on their ability to grasp policy or even read. I mean, that's something that I think, you know, if these abilities, grasping policies, remembering policies, reading policies, if they are so poor that they accidentally ignored their own laws, then that alone worries me. That's just my thoughts on it. I just find it all quite odd, but it's up to you to kind of let us know how you feel about it. And it will be interesting over the next few weeks to see what Conservatives, if any, continue to come out of the woodwork and sort of state their claim against the two men and call for them to resign. So far, it looks like a lot of Conservative MPs are sort of keeping quiet. There's only really, obviously, there's the ones that came out before, back when the scandal was at its peak in the winter time. But on top of that, as of recently, I think there's only a couple at the time of recording that have called for Johnson's resignation. So Nigel Mills, MP for Amber Valley, and Craig Whittaker, MP for Calder Valley, they've since come out and said, well, time for you to resign. Other than that, people seem to be keeping their heads down. Although something that is worth noting is that these fines may actually end up being the first round of many. And it looks like, you know, as reporters, for example, for The Guardian are speculating that Sunak probably won't get any more, but Johnson may well receive one or even a few more fines on top of what he's already had. So maybe that would add into, you know, more Conservatives coming out. We'll have to see. Let me know what you think. Can Sunak ride this wave and clamber back to being the Conservative Party's sweetheart, or is two back-to-back scandals and a nigh on intolerable cost of living crisis enough to kind of nail closed the coffin containing his chances of one day succeeding as Prime Minister? And that's something that he's not really openly stated that he wants to be Prime Minister, but you can't move for reports and for speculation and for kind of unnamed insider sources saying that that's absolutely on the agenda. So it's an assumption that most people have, is that if there were a leadership election tomorrow, Sunak would be in that pile. I think it's worth keeping an eye on the polls in terms of that. How are the public feeling about Rishi Sunak? And I also think it's worth keeping an eye on your finances. Because if people feel fundamentally horribly worse off for sustained periods of time, then I'm not sure that, you know, even the best spin doctor in the world could convince the public that everything's fine. But let me know your thoughts. You can follow me on Instagram at juliabell_x. And please, I'll remind you again, give Martin Lewis, the money-saving expert, a follow. I really recommend that. And pop to the oven door, please. They're so lovely in there. Anna took the time to talk to me today and to share her story. And I cannot tell you enough how good the baked goods are. They're really nice. So pop in there if you can, in Weatherby. And of course, if you want to keep this podcast going, please do become a patron. It's the only way really that you can guarantee that it can carry on rolling forward and carry on helping you to keep up. So it equates to about the price of a coffee or less every month. And you know, it means you're a part of a community, and it also kind of keeps me able to do these. So the link for Patreon is in the episode description as well. With that, I want you to look after yourselves. This is not going to be an easy year for most, but I will always try to just be here to strip it back and make it make sense for you at the very least. I'll speak to you in the next one. Goodbye.